the Norwegian method.
I'm Olav Alexander Bu, peak human performance developer, coach to Christian Blumenfeld and Gustav Eden.
I'm Dr. David Littman, a health and human performance specialist. Welcome to the Norwegian Method podcast. This week's episode is sponsored by Plasmade, a liquid performance and recovery supplement made from French maritime pine bark extract. For a 25% discount on Plasmade and to learn more, head to the show notes. Welcome back to the Norwegian Method podcast. We are on episode 6 of season 1. Joining me again is Olav, and we are talking all things biking, cycling. So I'm going to start with the first question. It's something you touched on in the last episode briefly and sort of glanced over, and I was going to not ask it, but now we didn't quite do it justice. Is there any merit in a swim bike brick session? We see a lot of run bike brick sessions, but what about swim bike sessions?
Yeah, there are. So yeah, there are merits absolutely to do swim bike bricks. One is, of course, to practice exactly getting off your wetsuit as quickly as possible and do it in a way that you don't rip it, because they do cost money. And then on the other side of it, getting onto the bike when you have a little bit fatigue in your body and you are wet too, it can also prove to be a little bit challenging. And of course, it depends also, do you take on your socks or your sleeves, or are you jumping barefoot into the shoes? But these are the things that will be different in a stress situation compared to when you are not. And to be honest, if you're looking to improve your time from 11 hours to 10:30, you're not wasting 1 minute in your transition zone that day. You really have to bring your A game also in transition. So you're looking to save time there. So this is not where you can get your break. Then you probably, if you need that break in the transition, then you would probably have benefited quite significantly from just slowing down slight bit on the pace on the swim, so that you basically can run effectively through the transition, get off your stuff, get wetsuit, get on your bike, jump on a bike and get out as quickly as possible. Because 1 minute, put it this way, if you're looking to prioritize to improve your swimming, how much will it cost you to improve 1 minute on swimming? That is quite a lot. Same also if you have your biking, how much does it cost to improve, for example, going from race power from 300 watts to 305 310 watts, for example? And then again, that's not even velocity, so you're looking at the time. How much time are you looking to improve here? The thing is that it costs quite a lot. So we already talked about, okay, maybe you should shift, maybe like for example for yourself, you say you're really strong, for example, on the bike and a run. So you could maybe then consider shifting maybe an hour of your training onto your swimming. And then basically, how much would you expect to improve on your swimming? A couple of minutes? You don't waste then afterwards one of those minutes in your transition. It doesn't
make any sense.
Does not make any sense at all. So this is why swim, bike, practice, so you really dial it in and you get faster. You can't afford losing time there, because that is 3 minutes, 3 seconds that you would get if you were just effective and you practiced it. And in shorter distances, like standard distance or Olympic distance and sprint distance, that can actually be the difference between winning and losing. Actually, even if you lose like 5 seconds, it's not like people are going out on a run and say, hey, but come on, you lost 5 seconds in transition, can you just run half a second faster on the kilometer? Nope. People are at the limits, and if they run half a second faster than a kilometer, they will probably explode when they get closer to 8-9 kilometers. You don't have any reserve. It's not like you're coming over the finish line and say, hey, I could have run faster.
Yep. And remembering again, with the exception of bragging rights, there's not a lot of reasons to want to swim faster and then waste some of that time in transition, right? If you exactly want to be the first or over swim for that matter. So you don't want to be optimizing for that. You're optimizing to be the first at the finish line, not first to T1.
Yeah, that's why you are not attending an open water competition and then you have a break and then you go to a bike race and then you have a break and then you go to a run race later in the day. You do a triathlon.
Yeah. So similar to that then, or on a similar thread, how much biking do you think is, as a baseline, optimal to do solo versus as a brick, be that swim bike brick or bike run brick? So I've got intrinsic biases here that around specificity, but I'm sure that your opinions will be a little bit different and hinge more on how this fits into key versus development sessions and how this fits into your gap analysis.
So brick sessions, the amount of, let's say, volume or duration that we put into brick sessions are limited. because it, again, it is an evaluation of where do you, how much is there to be gained. And for us, very often, yeah, there are some times where we need to practice a little bit more. So then it becomes more of a development session. But there are also times where we basically see that, okay, we are not able here to gain probably a second or something, like more than a second potentially. And that, that is important. But gaining that second very often then comes from technique or practice in the transition by just getting on your shoes faster, for example, or making sure that when you get in and you rack your bike and get your helmet off and all this kind of thing, that you have like practice, so it basically is reflexive. But a brick session, of course, is very also unspecific in the sense that really what you're practicing there is a short bike and then a transition and then a short run, which is not very specific. In that sense, you can say that a longer bike and then having like one transition and then doing a run is more specific, but then you're really that you have very short time practicing your brick. So this is a balance. This is purely a balance because a brick in itself, how it's built up, is not very specific because you're not gonna bike, run, bike, run, bike, run, bike, run. You are basically biking and then there's one transition between the bike and the run and you do a run afterwards. So bricks are primarily, I would say one is to make sure that you don't lose any time in the transition. But of course, if very often what happens is that you, when after your bike, you are like, you really struggle with the running afterwards. Most likely this has to do with then the amount of fatigue that you have induced until you actually get off the bike there. So probably for most people, I would probably say that it lies in that people are swimming or and biking above their abilities to get the fastest possible to T2, and then they really start to suffer when they get out on the run. Because everybody, if they go and they do an easy ride and then you do a, let's say that now you just practice a quick transition over to a run, you would feel that okay, actually running fast is not a problem. So basically this induced fatigue that comes there. It's not like you can just redistribute then the volume a little bit and just say, hey, I'm now gonna do a little bit more breaks there. That will necessarily solve it. You just rather have to look a little bit on your profile and basically maybe hold back a little bit more on the bike in order to set you up for the fastest possible run. Because in the end, it's very often, because we do things isolated, it's very easy when you're on the bike that, for example, if you do like best average, for example. So let's say you go out on your bike and do your best average interval. So you do typically FTP intervals and you do them closer to exhaustion. Is that you are looking now to, you want to bring also your A game to that single session. You want to have like progress on that FTP session because everybody, that's your bragging number, for example, or what everybody talks about, whether you brag about it or not. And the problem is there that if you focus too much on that and you're spending your volume of training on doing that, so you really become good there and you also become good exactly to bike hard when you're fresh, you haven't learned to properly pace yourself after you've been swimming and setting you up for a perfectly good run afterwards. And this is difficult. So that's why it is important to understand a little bit, okay, where is the sweet spot between how hard I can bike and then set me up for like the fastest possible run. And this is something you should spend time on investigating and get a good feel for. But a pure brick where you do bike run, that's not necessarily gonna bring that very much to attention. That's more like just practicing transition and let's say call it for somebody the shock of getting out on the run after they've been biking hard. But it might be that it's more important to find out actually what actually is the best balance between what kind of power output should you look for the duration that you are on the bike, and then have the fastest, or let's say the combination of the fastest bike and run afterwards. Because that's, again, what's going to bring you closer to the podium or up higher on the podium or make an even bigger gap between you and number two on the podium. So balance between the two is important, and I think here is probably where most people fail because they isolate them, and because when you isolate them, you can normally run always harder, you can always bike much harder, and it doesn't become very specific in that sense because you are fresh. And there being aware of that is important. And that means that, for example, you could then, for example, one way, if you're looking for a certain making a dent in the curve, that potentially one way to do that would be bringing down the power a little bit on the bike, but extending rather the intervals a little bit instead to bring a little bit closer to what you think is sustainable, but still being able to have like, making a dent or that that development to that power curve.
It sounds like the genesis of some of what you hear from anybody who's a triathlete, which is running off the bike is really weird and it feels funny for a while. It sounds like the genesis of some of that is a poor understanding of sustainable power on the bike given swimming intensity, because they do so little swim bike. They do so much isolated bike or something like this. The power they're holding is probably a touch high on that bike because they're not accounting for the swim, which is then having a knock-on effect to the run being compromised as a result.
Yeah, and then also when you are racing, you probably have some competitors that you want to beat, and it's very hard to let them go on the bike because you are afraid of, like, okay, now I'm not meeting my targets and this kind of thing. And that's also why I think it's very important to stick to what you know works in training and then bridge that into racing. That's what we practice for. And I think at the same side also that if you have turbo at home, which most people have, an ergometer where you put your bike on, and if you are one of the lucky guys that also have a treadmill or don't, you don't need it. But if you have an ergometer at home, I would actually, when you do an FTP session, sometimes just get out, run for 5, 10, 15 minutes after, straight off the bike there a little bit to get a feel for it. And when you do that, you also develop a sensation for exactly how is it to run off the bike, and maybe you're also getting closer to exactly understanding what is sustainable. But of course, this is something we are looking to develop. So it's not like enough doing it like one time early in the season and then, okay, that's how it's going to be. Because you are also practicing exactly to become more fitter, faster, powerful. And when you do that, of course, then you need to get a feel exactly for what, okay, when you've done like a really good, let's say, key session, for example, on the bike, how does it feel then when you get off and you start running? And you don't need more than, let's say, 5, 10, 15 minutes to get a really like a feel for how is it to do that. And this is also where you will feel that, like, doing that also after an easy session, for example, or something that sits around, let's say, the power target that you're looking for, even the power, if the power target at this time of the season, you are just keeping that power in the maintenance session, so you're not even close to fatigue. It's just something you do for a very short duration. You're not, maybe you do it for on an easy ride that lasts for 2 hours, 1 hour, 2 hours, and you're sitting around that race power, for example. Now this is a maintenance session, so you also know that this is something I know that I can easily hold for probably 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours, but you're only doing it for 1, 2 hour. Still get off, run, and what you will feel actually when you only do it for 1 or 2 hours, that's actually, it's very easy to run, and you can actually just power away also on the run there because you don't have that fatigue. So basically, very often what happens is the people are overestimating a little bit the cost of the bike. They get excited about people passing by them. They know they're a strong biker. A lot of triathletes, they define themselves, oh, I'm an Uber biker or these kind of things. And what ends up is that you actually are destroying your triathlon.
Fastest swim bike,
yeah,
runner, not fastest biker or swimmer or
fastest
something.
Triathlete.
Exactly. Let's talk about bike volume. Given the what we've talked about already, which is the duration taken for these different modalities, right? So the bike is by far the longest. You obviously need to devote the most time and the most volume to that. How does that vary for somebody who's looking to perhaps maintain that portion of the triathlon versus develop it? So how much time would you allot extra to it? Because it's also, in comparison to something like running, it's not such a big injury risk. It's not so taxing. So you can actually sustain a lot more bike volume than anything else. And there seems to be a bike-heavy emphasis in all triathlon, including Olympic distance, which we won't talk about, but we'll talk about off-air. But so I guess, how are you apportioning volume in the context of wanting to develop the bike versus somebody who just needs to maintain it?
So if you're looking to maintain your bike, again, I think you pinpoint actually one of the things that is really good with a bike, and that is you can sustain a quite big volume of training there. And as long as you believe that volume, there's a correlation between volume and fitness, then of course, even though you're looking to maintain it, you don't drop it, you look to maintain it. But what you have to be careful about is exactly the intensity that you are putting in here. And of course, volume is a function of intensity and duration. So I think that if you're looking to maintain it, you would probably still bring in some intervals and other things like that, but it's only that the volume of work that you do at higher intensity is going to be less, to be 100% sure that it doesn't impair, for example, your run development, if you're looking to distribute it that way, or towards the swim, for example. And you would always probably also most of the time then use it as your second session, even after you run, for example, and make faster progress on the run, for example, or set you up for a better runner if you're purely looking to increase your pace on the run. For the for target duration. But if like fatigue is a problem, obviously you can also move it then beforehand. But again, if you're looking to maintain it, I think most important of what you say is that it's one of the places where you can have a high volume without risking getting injured. It's very good in that sense. So it doesn't make necessarily sense to bring very much down the duration of your maybe of your bike sessions, but you would bring down the volume, so the intensity of those sessions you would bring down, and so that they more become that you're keeping your routine, you have it there, and when you eventually decide, okay, now I have to put a little bit more effort into the bike, you have the routine there, you have everything is in place there, you have the movement, you are efficient.
Today's episode is provided by VO2 Master, your solution in making informed training decisions and unlocking advanced insights into human performance. Upgrade your training and metabolic assessments with the user-friendly VO2 Master Analyzer. VO2 Max, RMR, CPET with the reliability, accuracy, and portability that you want. Use the code OLAVMETHOD, that's OLAVMETHOD, during checkout at VO2Master.com to get a free assessment kit with the purchase of your first VO2 Master Analyzer. So it sounds like in the contrast of strong cyclists versus weak cyclists, the real difference in that program would be around how much intensity they're doing, how much the duration of that intensity they're doing, and you would apportion that elsewhere to develop those modalities, be that swim or run, yeah, rather than removing duration from that cycling program, because yeah, the duration isn't particularly costly if the intensity isn't there, and because that duration is still going to have knock-on effects to the run and knock-on effects elsewhere, and it's low risk duration.
And one thing that is, of course, is that you can also use this as is that, for example, if you're out running, so let's say that you are a little bit compromised on time, a good way there is, of course, that then you can, one way or an alternative is that you can make now your run much more condensed and focused around exactly that development where you're looking to develop, or what is high priority for you.
And you're talking about an intensity for that?
Yeah. And also how close you're bringing yourself to, let's say, exhaustion. Yep. So you don't have many, let's say, intervals in reserve anymore. And then instead of doing a cool down there, you jump on a bike and you do, let's say, a part of your bike there now as a cool down instead. So in this way, you get more effective time running, and you jump on a bike and you actually use that also effectively as a cool down. So you get in, you get in the duration or the hours that you are looking for maybe, and you're bringing it together in a way that allow you to be even more effective on the run.
All right. Where do you see your system and the way you coach the guys differing to traditional bike programs? How would you contrast those? Where is your biggest difference, do you think?
I think that on the bike, because this is effectively also a transportation stage, you are not going to win a triathlon, neither on the swim, not on the bike, but you can definitely lose it there.
Yep.
So obviously you have to be good. But I would say that for us, of course, we emphasize the bike a little bit more just purely because there is a longer duration that is happening on the bike proportionally to run and swim. And also because we think that the fastest triathlon time can be achieved by that you actually have, you can't be, if you prioritize too much time on, for example, a swim and becoming like trying to save those another 10, 15, 30 seconds on the swim there, you can gain much more on the bike for the same time invested. So that's why, and I would say even more too. So if you're just looking to do the fastest possible triathlon, having a good balance between the three is, then bike is important. Of course, in draft legal racing, you can't have a too of a big gap because then you have the peloton effect, and that is massive. You still also have a little bit of drafting effect, of course, in an Ironman, but there it's getting a little bit more marginal. And the benefit that you actually get in a draft illegal race like an Ironman is that if you come a little bit later up of the water, there is actually quite a lot of people you can you will be able to draft on, and then you can go forward. So you get a little bit of benefit of that. Being the guy in the front all the time is lonely and it is tough and it costs more energy, even though the what savings of being 12 meters or 20 meters behind the guy in front, 20 meters, then I would say it's highly marginal. What you would be able to save 12 meters, yes, then there is a little bit of an effect, and then enough that it makes a difference to do it. But So there you can maybe sacrifice even a little bit more. But on the longest day, and proportionally also the bike is so much longer compared to the swim than it is in Olympic racing. So, but on Olympic racing, and without going very much more, we have to prioritize a little bit different. And there are proportionally more focus on the swim. But in an Ironman, I would say that you have, again, this comes down to a little bit what we talked about in one of the previous episodes, and that is that how you balance this is a matter of how much time do you think on your total time, how much would you be able to save on your bike, how much would you be able to save on your run, how much would you be able to save on your swim by redistributing a little bit of time here. And that is what matters in the end.
So I guess to summarize how you differ, you probably emphasize the combination of the three for context on the bike more than others. So your approach to biking is in context of the other two more so, and you are probably doing slightly more emphasis on the bike compared to swim than many other coaches would be, is probably the two to take away, aside from the generic things or the global things that I think you differ in, which is things like intensity control. It's how you're apportioning calorie budget, those sort of things, which are across all modalities. They're not bike specific. Is that a fair summary for me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So I want to bring back in a little bit the method here, because it is important for me that we don't lose focus on that, or that our listeners doesn't lose focus on that, because being methodical is important. So first of all, the performance model, you're looking at, okay, velocity, power, calorimetry, where basically is it that you can save time, where, how efficient are you, is it free speed basically just by changing some of your setup, then really it's not important to focus on it, because then it will come anyway when you do that, and you need very little, other things need more time for it to be developed. So that's one. How much are we able to impact total time? Then reverse engineer exactly how much time do we need to spend in order to make an impact on what we are trying to change. And secondly, or thirdly, it is the budget, because this is ultimately your limitation in the end. And when you are able to train 20 hours a week, for example, you're already able to expend a lot of energy. You can easily run into a calorie deficit when you are at 20 hours over short-term and long-term, even including your recovery days. So it doesn't help sometimes just to redistribute or let's say bring down the intensity a little bit, and you're just keeping up the hours that you're doing, because the volume is still too high, for example, meaning now you're burning too much calories in total over those 20 hours you're doing. So sometimes you might actually benefit from holding back or bleeding off a little bit of the duration, and then also effectively also the volume that you are capable of doing on the biking, exactly to make sure that you are in a calorie balance, so that you are capable of executing executing, that's one, but actually also recovering properly from those other important sessions that you then have to find that there are more times to be gained, let's say for example on your swim and your run.
Awesome. I think that's a really, really good summary, and I think it's really poignant for people to really consider. And again, all training should be considered in broader context, so any modality should be considered in context of the other modalities, but all training should be considered in the context of that week, that month, that year, that season, because these things all impact each other, and having a narrow focus on this session, beating somebody or putting out a big number or running a fast time, if that is purely for motivation and it happens once every now and again, maybe once every 6 months, okay, maybe there's a discussion there, but otherwise it seems to be narrow-sided.
And then I think also, of course, one thing we haven't talked very much about yet, we talked about wetsuits, for example. How do you select the right wetsuit? On the bike, because it has such a long duration, 4 hours, 5 hours, 6 hours, depending on your level, then this is, of course, a place where marginal gains can have a big impact on time savings. So one place where you shouldn't really go wrong is what kind of tires you have on your bike. So we have our own rolling friction rig. We have been testing so many different tires and on different surfaces and also with different pressures. And the thing is that tires alone is probably a place where you can easily lose 10-20 watts that goes purely into propulsion. So it's pure mechanical loss, frictional loss. And that's going to have a massive impact on your time. Of course, initially, of course, aerodynamics is going to have the biggest impact. But at some point when you have been around for some while and you have been, you are at the level where you are training 20 hours a week, but then maybe biking already 10 hours a week or maybe even more, you already probably have dialed in a fairly good position. And there you're now looking more for marginal gains. The watts that now can be saved there sustainably over a race. And this is the very important part. Sustainably over a race is getting closer to what is marginal. We're looking for watt savings, more or less. Helmets is very easy to say, oh, there was a wind tunnel test and that helmet tested 3 watts faster than the other one. Yes, that is in an ideal position. The thing is, you're not going to be in an ideal position for 180 kilometers, most likely. That means that those 3 watts can easily be lost by that, for example, you're starting to move around a little bit, your head starts to drift a little bit, and suddenly that helmet is not more efficient than, for example, a less, call it aerodynamic helmet. Because we also, what the most important thing we actually focus on, there's a difference between track cycling and, for example, Ironman cycling. On a track or a velodrome, you're looking for peak aerodynamic performance. On the road, when you're doing an Ironman, what will be peak is something that is averaged over a course that is 180 kilometers with different wind directions, different where you are biking a little bit up, you're biking a little bit down, there are technical corners, you will be sitting upright, and you also have to be aware of your surroundings. On a track, you can actually optimize learning to just look straight down on the line. And when you practice enough, you don't have to move your head at all. You don't even have to look very much forward. You can look just enough forward that you know that you are where you are supposed to be. You know when the corner is coming and you're just sticking to that position 100% for the course of the event, an hour, for example. While when you're out, then again, you have to be aware of your surroundings. That's probably the highest risk for people. If you're forcing yourself into position, you are forced eventually to then have a look around. Otherwise, you potentially crash or you violate the distance to the athlete in front of you. So that means there will be naturally more head movement. Then another part, which is heavily underlooked, is thermodynamics and thermoregulation. A very aerodynamic helmet is unfortunately very often a compromise between how much air you are ventilating through your helmet as well. Because ventilating or causing vents where air can go through is effectively, for example, like a venturi. And a venturi increases the drag of that object. So if you're forcing more air to go through, let's say, a more narrow section, that means that basically now you're effectively causing air molecules to collide, compress, and that is causing effectively drag. On a road helmet, of course, there you have much more like open ventilation. And you can say, okay, well, that normally then would cause a little bit more of drag. And of course, on aero helmets, they're always trying to make this venturi effects and vents more and more efficient, exactly to allow for good ventilation. But it will still be a little bit more restricted than it will be for a road helmet. But then on the other side, also, there are road helmets today that are so close to TT helmets in terms of performance that I would say that the difference we find between TT helmets and road helmets is not big of a difference. And I would say that probably for most athletes, they will actually probably be faster with a road helmet than a TT helmet. Purely because when you're starting to move around in your head, the road helmet actually provides more robust aerodynamics than necessarily what a TT helmet is doing.
And it gives you better ventilation, which helps you cool more, and a large portion of humans' cooling is through the head.
Yeah, and that you won't be able to detect in a wind tunnel because, for example, in a wind tunnel or when you're on a velodrome and you're doing like 5-minute tests or something like this, you're not really bringing up your temperature. While you're racing 180K and especially in Kona, for example, where it's hot, then cooling will be important because performance is not only physiologically, it's also psychologically. And if you are already starting to become very hot-headed, probably not exactly the right way to put it, but
it's appropriate hot-headed. As well. If you're hot-headed, it's going to be a problem, and if your head is hot, it's going to be a problem as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. So that means that, again, here, if you are starting to become a little bit mentally unaware, or you're slowing down mentally, you don't have necessarily now the cognitive ability to focus exactly on like really good efficient running, which again will slow you more down. So now you have to look at, okay, how much does this aero helmet bring me in terms of potential time saving versus if I start to come off and then basically I'm a little bit more unfocused and this kind of thing. Remember, it's very easy exactly to get a little bit hot-headed on the bike, because this is where everybody, it's easy to accelerate, it's easy to put in a little bit more power. Suddenly there comes your neighbor or your work colleague or somebody else that you're looking to beat passing by you. You are afraid of letting them go and you just start to put in the power. You're losing a little bit your focus on your target. And this can easily be how to say, bridged up on the run. If you just stick to your targets, you are staying a little bit more cool. And yeah, in the end, it is who is coming over the finish line first that...
Yeah, it's not a race to T2. It's a race to the finish line.
Exactly.
And I'd say as well, I think my takeaway from that is it's important to optimize in context, not optimize in a vacuum. So having the best helmet isn't about having the most aerodynamic helmet. It's having the best helmet for aerodynamics and cooling in the context of 180K cycle after a swim.
Yeah, exactly.
Today's episode is sponsored by Morton, the leader in fueling for endurance sports. With patented hydrogel technology, Morton found a way for athletes like Christian and Gustav to tolerate more carbohydrate during training and racing. The advances in performance when using the Morton gels, drink mixes, and bicarb system have been clear. It's the fuel behind triathlon gold medals, world championships, and world records. Hydrogel technology has no added flavor, preservatives, or colors, and is made with only natural ingredients, so it's clean. Only what's required to aid performance, nothing more. And now you can benefit from the same world-class fueling system thanks to an exclusive one-time code that will give our listeners 20% off the Morton 1/52 collection, a curated selection of products to fuel a 1 week of structured training. Especially in training, every fueling moment counts. It's how athletes adapt and race better. Simply add the 1/52 collection to your basket at Morton.com and enter the code in our show notes at the checkout. Well, let's go. So the next question there is, you talked about aero position already, and we're not going to go into that because that's a podcast series in itself, and we can't do that justice. But we also talked a little bit before, and I think it was a good discussion around testing, and you talked about time in trainer versus outdoor and how that will affect things. How much time should people be in TT bars versus not in prep for an Ironman? Is it just a matter of, hey, let's spend a couple of sessions as maintenance throughout the most of the year, and then by the time we get closer to Ironman, that becomes a key development session, and therefore we need to spend a lot of time in aero bars because you need to be comfortable in that for, let's call it 160 kilometers because there'll be some time out for cornering or whatever else.
So I think this will then bring us to position also, because the thing is that how much time you should bring in your TT position is of course also an effect of how drastically different your TT position is from, for example, your road bike position or your more upright position. If there is a big difference between the two, and you typically see that, for example, let's say that you're riding 300 watts and time to exhaustion in your TT bars is much shorter, or where it really starts to become uncomfortable to keep your position, then you need to practice this much more, or you have to reconsider your TT position. So again, it is very much an effect of how aggressive your TT position is. But then again, if there's a huge difference between the two positions, let's say that position, then you know that on race day that most likely is sustainable. You have had a bike fitter or a coach or other looking at you, and you've been working on it, and they have experience with that. Then I would say that then it's important exactly to practice it, because your aerodynamic capabilities is not static. They are something you actually develop, much in the same way that you develop power, you develop aerodynamics. And we also have to remember that velocity is most affected by watts per CDA. Again, because when you are staying at around 300 watts, if you have a good position, you can easily exceed 40 kilometers per hour. And now basically 80% of the drag actually comes from your body. And then we also know that the difference, if you just sit at 300 watts and you go upright on the bike, how much the velocity drops. It is a massive drop in velocity if you sit more upright on the bike. So how much time should you spend in the TT bars? I would say a large portion of it, but you can start off a little bit more softer. So you start off with maybe a little bit less time in the TT bars, and then you gradually increase the time in the TT bar, focus on relaxing. But then also on the other side, you can also go with maybe a little bit less aggressive TT position in the beginning, and then you gradually bring down the stack also the further you also get out into the season. I would probably advise on not changing the position equally much and bringing it down. Can be an idea, but that can also be effectively mitigated by just putting, let's say, for example, a towel or anything like this under your armrest and your elbows to bring you up a little bit higher. But in general, being in TT bars and comfortably and navigating your bike also comfortably is a function also of how much time you are spending in the TT bar. And being in the TT bar is what is specific. It's a little bit, of course, I'm exaggerating now a little bit, but it's almost like you don't go in the pool and practice breaststroke to become good at freestyle. You have to practice freestyle, and that's a little bit the thing here. You're not a road cyclist. You are a time trialist, and that means also you have to practice as a time trialist. And your hip angles will be more acute in the TT position. Your neck, the stress on your neck will be different in the TT position as opposed to being in a road position. So I think this is something that also very often people take a little bit too lightly on. They just sit upright on the bike because it's more comfortable, and they're looking at the power numbers, and they see that, of course, power goes down when they go into the TT position. Well, if it does, you have to practice this more, and it will come up, and it will be much more rewarding on race day than just then focusing on that bigger power as you're sitting upright on the bike. Because remember the performance model. What you really are trying to impact is your time over the distance that you are competing. Bring down that time. That is the only thing that matters in the end. Even on your bike, let's say that you're motivated by being an Uber biker. That's what really brings you fun. What's going to be on the rest of the list is then, okay, maybe you're not looking to improve your total time. Let's say you're trying to improve your bike split or whatever. Then basically still is time that is reported on that result list there. So as long as you're doing that, velocity is king, and velocity is a function of power minus efficiency losses. And the biggest efficiency loss you have is your CDA. That's the single biggest one. Of course, at some point, then you're looking for margins there, and there are other things that might make a big difference, like we said, like tires, making sure that your chain and everything like these kind of things are optimized. But your suit, yeah. But the point is exactly that if you go out on the road and you just do a simple test the next time you're out riding and you're sitting 300 watts upright on your bars like you would do on a turbo just to hold that bigger power number, and you go into an air position, your velocity will go up like massively. Even if you're pedaling 200 watts, it will go up massively. And that's why it is so important to practice that aerodynamic position, getting comfortable in it and being able to relax it. It's going to be frustrating in the beginning because you feel you have to get out of the bars more often. You have to get back in. You are fatiguing. You're maybe not able to keep your session. But then again, think of it this way rather. If you're out on the road and when you were in that air position, you were holding or 200 watts, for example, or 300 watts, and you were now going upright in that position, and then you were going at 35 kilometers per hour. Okay, how much less power could you actually go with and still go at 35 kilometers per hour? Well, okay, let's say that 50 watts less, for example, then that means basically you can go in on your turbo now and practice at 50 watts less. And you would still have, you're still aiming now for the same time. And you're probably also preserving more carbohydrates also for that run in the end, which is also very important. So don't go obsessive over the power numbers, especially in an upright position. Rather sacrifice a little bit on the power in the upright position and be rather focusing on getting comfortable in that aerodynamic position that is sustainable, which is safe, that allows you to navigate effectively, be there, and set you up for a really good run afterwards, and then look at developing power in that position, not in an upright position.
I think there's some stuff I'll underscore there for listeners. I think one thing is the caveat here is always that's all very relevant if the course is going to be one that you want to attack on TT bars. If not, obviously some of that doesn't apply, right? So if you decide to ride Nice without TT bars for whatever reason, okay, then some of that doesn't apply and you need to be cornering more or something like that. The other thing is, again, the context, which is your position needs to facilitate a good run afterwards. So if you are in a slightly better aero position, but it means that you can't run well because you're cramping or you're having other problems, or you've got hip flexor fatigue, or you've got a sore back, then, or your neck sore, then you need to address that. And it might be that your position needs to change over years, and it might be that you develop into a position, right? You may be that year one, you can't do that, and then year two, you can, and year three, you can get into an even better position. So consider this as a longer term project as well, potentially, because your function will change over time. Your body will adapt structurally as well as functionally.
To give an example there, Milwaukee. Christian came out of the water, first group. After a short while, the gap opens up. Christian is 30 seconds away. Or opens up a gap of 30 seconds. 1 minute. 1.5 minute. 2 minutes. But then he starts to feel it in his groin. And of course, it should then be said that the time that Christian actually got on his TT bike this year before Milwaukee was a couple of hours. We did not have the time to really dial it into his capabilities, because your aerodynamic capabilities or your position on the bike will be a function of how much time you actually spend in that position there. So Christian had to go with a position that he thought was good, because again, we didn't have the time to spend a lot of focus on trying to dial in a good position. We had to go with something that we know is close to best practice. And as most of our listeners will then remember, is that Christian cramped up on the run, but actually it was not because of the run. This was purely because of his bike position. And we already saw indicators of this in on the one of the sessions that he had. He were able then to get in like a TT ride on before the race, that he on left, I think it was on the left groin, he's already said that there is a bit of stress there. But then, okay, so we got, I think we had like one or two more rides, something like this. And you really don't know, okay, do we dare do make big changes now to the position, which we then have, can only test now on one more ride, or we don't effectively can test it at all? Or do we hope that this actually will work for Milwaukee? And again, Milwaukee was a low priority race. It was not something that he would taper for or anything like this. He would just basically get in one or two or three rides on the TT bike, then jump on the plane, travel there, and bring out what he was capable on that day. And of course, we saw that he was really fast on the bike. But unfortunately, we should just have gone, done that adjustment. And that was the difference we actually did between Milwaukee and Singapore. So Singapore, of course, now we have even no more time between Milwaukee and Singapore to actually practice his TT bike. So he effectively jumps on his bike for Singapore, like one easy turbo session indoors in the evening before he leaves for Singapore. This is the this is the evening before, I think it was the Paris test event, where he jumps then on the bike in the TT position, and we start to look and we look on his position. The changes we actually made there based on his experience from Milwaukee was that we moved the seat up 0.5 centimeter and forward 1 centimeter. 0.5 centimeter up, 1 centimeter forward. And that was what made the difference between basically where he felt it in his groin and he ended up cramping heavily in Milwaukee, towards basically producing a blistering run split in Singapore. So this is basically how much a small change can basically make of a difference. We took a calculated risk, got penalized for that in Milwaukee. We then made some effective changes leading to Singapore, which paid off. But the thing is that small changes, especially when you start to get more aggressive, can have huge consequences for the output. And that's why, if you're a little bit uncertain, go a little bit safe. And very often it's about bringing up your cockpit by 1 centimeter, or maybe bring your seat into a position which is a little bit more comfortable. And that is sometimes what I needed. But again, back to the topic, aerodynamics, they are important, but they have to be sustainable. And of course, this is something you get better at with practicing more time. And you will never find the optimal position if you don't spend time on it. before your race. If you end up jumping on a bike three rides before your race, well, then you are highly limited also in what you can also bring out on that day, because then CDA will probably have a bigger impact on everything than everything else you are going to optimize on.
And the best way, I might summarize what I assume you're going to say, is like the best way to test this for somebody who doesn't have a wind tunnel is probably to look at speed versus power and how that looks on a long straight road in relatively reproducible conditions, and test different positions, test different tires, as we've talked about, perhaps test different heights of cockpits, etc. That's the testing field that you need to use, because you're not going to have a lab, you're not going to have a velodrome and all those things. And to be honest, it's probably more relevant to an Ironman is go find a road, which is what you're going to ride on, not a velodrome, and go use a portion there to really test this and use it for periods of time that are reasonable. So look at perhaps doing 15, 20 minute blocks if you can, and that, not a 2 minute ride and go, okay, yeah, that's my heart rate for that 2 minute, or that's my power, or that's my speed for 2 minutes. It's like use something that's more representative, a longer block perhaps.
Yeah. And of course, if you have access to a velodrome, that's of course super, but that's the same thing when we talked about here also in a previous episode, getting access to a lab and doing metabolic testing. It's not very accessible for most people. Of course, we are getting more and more equipment that are being democratized, so people can do it on their own or with a coach wherever they want, but it's not readily available for people, and a velodrome even less. So there are not many people that have access to it. It costs also a bit of money to do that. It's more rigid protocols. It's quite intrusive in your training. So I completely agree. The best thing, there are some approaches, like there is one approach we have used for a decade, which is called virtual elevation. And when you do virtual elevation, you basically don't need very much fancy equipment. Of course, temperature, pressure, and these kind of things will have an impact, but everything here, I can tell you, is better than nothing. So just looking purely at your power to speed ratio, and if you do that again a couple of times, or maybe more correctly, power to velocity ratio, then looking at this, because here you can also imagine if you go into like a very aggressive position and you start like swaying from side to side a little bit more on the road, yes, you might be able to, the speed will look, the difference between speed and velocity here will be almost marginal anyway. So, but the point is that to look just at power to speed ratio, is one way to really look at your position. Another way to do this is that if you have access to a tunnel, not wind tunnel actually, but just a road tunnel, or a hill where the conditions are fairly constant, then you can also do rolling tests. So you just get up a little bit in the hill, for example, and then basically you get into your position and then you start rolling, and you're looking basically at, okay, between, for example, 2 points, where how what is your velocity between that, given of course that the conditions are, if you get a little bit here of a headwind or things, that will start to influence it. But the thing is that the more often you do this, of course, and you don't necessarily always have to do it structured, sometimes if you're just passing this segment, stop your bike, get into your position, roll past it, and that's it. And then you collect data every time you go here and you learn something from that. It's very easy sometimes that, and I'm a victim of this, and that is I want to do everything fairly perfect, and if it's not, then I might not prioritize it. But the value of accumulating big data and then rather look for the averages in this over time very often produces better results than necessarily just looking for that one time spot snapshot of you, because that might not be representative at all.
Awesome. I think that bike episode is really, really good. I think the things to take away from this are the bike is in context more than people probably appreciate it. So it needs to be considered post-swim, pre-run. What effect is it having? What effect is the swim having? What effect is it having on the run? Make sure you're not over biking, and that is heavily affected by intensity of the swim as well. So really consider that. Think about doing some testing in whatever way you have access to, and you can, as you've said, it doesn't have to be much more than just power meter, or maybe not even power meter, and then GPS, and then perhaps some aero positions. Think about all of your gear, because CDA is going to be a huge portion of this. It's going to perhaps influence things more than anything else, so really consider drag once you're starting to optimize, and that has more components than just your position. It has wheels, it has other gear, clean your chain, all that stuff has a big component to to you going faster. So I think it's a great way to end it, Olav. Thank you again. We'll be back next time with the episode on run. So there it is, the bike, cycling, all things bike cycling done. Please do share this with somebody that you think would learn from it, be they cyclist, triathlete, or anything in between. Of course, if you haven't already, rate the podcast, subscribe to it so you get our next episode, which you guessed it will be on running. And of course, if you have any questions, send them via Instagram DM to the Centara Tech Instagram account, via email to info@centaragroup.com, or drop them into Spotify in the question and answer feature down there. We will see you next week. Thank you very much. The Norwegian method.